House dropped out of the great vessel's hold to hover in neatly organized squadrons, like pilot fish around a large shark. Seeing the military force, the honored Matres could have no question about the newcomer's intent. Her communications officer hit the transmit toggle. Mother Commander Mirbella of the New Sisterhood wishes to speak with Helica. A woman responded in a defiant tone. You are referring to the Matre Superior. You will show proper respect. Mirbella's voice was infused with confident authority. As will you. I have come to facilitate your surrender. The woman sounded indignant and outraged, but moments later another voice took control. Brash words from an opponent I know is weak. We have annihilated whole worlds. A highliner and a handful of ships do not frighten us. Oh? Even if we carry some of the planet-burning weapons you yourself used on Richesi. We are not unarmed either, Helica retorted. I remain unconvinced of the need to surrender. Instead of being intimidated, Mirbella felt more confident. If Helica truly possessed such defenses, she would have attacked preemptively instead of issuing a warning. Your bravado bores me, Helica. You know that the rest of the honored Matre rebels have either joined the new sisterhood or been annihilated. Your cause is lost. We should try to find another solution. Let us meet, face to face. The Matre Superior gave a brittle chuckle. I will meet with you, if only to show you your weakness. Mirbella knew full well how the honored Matres thought. They saw the mere suggestion of negotiation to be a deep flaw in the Bene Gesserit way. Helica would seize any opening, probably attempt to assassinate her, assuming she could then take control of the sisterhood. Mirbella counted on it. Good. I will come down to Bandalong with my escort of 60 ships. Together, we will reach a resolution. Come if you dare. The Matre Superior cut off the transmission. Mirbella could almost hear the sound of a trap snapping shut. Earlier, the Mother Commander had pondered the possibility of capturing the Pretender Queen alive, bringing her into the new sisterhood as an ally. Niella from Gamu had killed herself rather than be converted. No great loss. But after the heinous destruction of Richesi, Mirbella had realized that capturing Helica would be like bringing an armed time bomb back to Chapter House. The Matre Superior needed to be destroyed. Duncan would never have made such a tactically foolish error. Mirbella joined one of the Valkyrie ships and began her descent toward Bandalong. These vessels had been sufficient to conquer Boozel and Gamu in impressive shows of force, but not overwhelming. The Matre Superior would naturally assume that her followers could defeat them. If you don't want an opponent to see your hidden dagger, make certain an obvious weapon looks large and deadly. Her ships approached the waiting palace. Our defenses can become liabilities if they betray our true weaknesses to the enemy. Bashar Miles Tegg, address to troops. From the call to arms and the groups of scurrying honored Matres in Bandalong, Uxtal could tell that the newly arrived Highliner was not merely another curious delegation from the Navigators. This was something far more serious. Since he had already demonstrated his success in reawakening the Waf Gola's memories, Edric was satisfied. Why would the Guild be bothering them now? He was working as fast as he could. Thus far, Uxtal had succeeded in covering up the significant flaws in the Tlilaxu master's knowledge. To make matters worse, during the sudden emergency, he received a summons to go to the palace of Bandalong immediately. He hurried off toward the sickeningly ostentatious building. As he ran the gauntlet of the colonnaded entry, he ignored the magenta columns and the garishly dressed statues of honored matres arrayed in threatening positions. A cowed-looking bonded male stood in a bright yellow tuxedo outside the immense door, wearing a dazed expression. Striding up to him, Uxtal lifted his chin in a disdainful sniff, since he had never been sexually twisted by the honored matres himself. "I am here to see the matre superior." The man blinked at him and said dully, "She is occupied setting up a trap for the witches. We have been threatened by the new sisterhood." Bene Gesserit witches? So that was what all the turmoil was about. Overhead in the sky, a swarm of dark ships was descending like a flock of carrion birds. Uxtal watched nervously, expecting explosives to drop onto the rooftops. Helica certainly had a way of provoking other people. The researcher held out the rolled message he had received. "Perhaps the Matre Superior wants me at her side during the emergency. I am her greatest living researcher. The man who will restore melange production from the axolotl tanks. My work may be the key to her negotiations." He crossed his arms over his small chest. "Yes, that must be the real reason. If the witches from Chapter House counted on their spice monopoly, then Helica would want to flaunt Uxtal's success with the Waffgola. She would offer him as her champion genius. Also, Navigator Edric would surely never allow harm to come to his work. Uxtal should be safe, no matter what happened." The tuxedoed man studied the summons, nodded sagely, and then dashed Uxtal's preconceptions. "Ah, now I understand. This is not, in fact, from the Matre Superior. We have prepared a room. Follow me." "Shouldn't you at least inform her that I am here?" "No. I was given specific instructions on that account." Confused and uneasy, the little researcher was escorted down a wide corridor that featured paintings of dead Bene Gesserits in macabre poses. The bonded male indicated for him to pass through an archway and descend a stairway to a large, sunken chamber. When Uxtal stepped down into the main room, alone, the entire chamber glowed orange as thousands of luminous eyes appeared in the floor. Terrified, he tried to retreat, but the whole staircase melted into the wall, trapping him like an unarmed slave in a combat arena. "Matre Superior, what is it you require of me?" He thought furiously, reminding himself, "They need me. That is why I am still alive. They need me." The glowing eyes in the floor went dark, plunging the sunken room into blackness. Through his panic, he became aware of a trickle of noise that entered the chamber like a stream running down the wall. Growing louder, the sound metamorphosed into a woman's grating laughter. "You see, my eyes are always on you, little man." Burning light filled the room, dazzling him. Peering through his fingers, Uxtal saw Ingva standing before him completely naked. Her aged body was carved from knots of muscle and taut skin. Her breasts were too small to sag. "The Matre Superior clearly does not want you. And now, while she is preoccupied with the Chapter House witches, I will claim you for my own. Then you will really work for me. Helica need never know until I decide to make my move." But I have done everything requested of me. His voice cracked. I have grown golas, produced your orange spice drug, restored the Tliloxu master's memories. Soon I will provide you with all the melange you could possibly... Exactly. And that is why I must control you. Against all of my expectations, you have actually proved yourself to be of value. She moved closer, and he felt like a mouse transfixed by a viper. From this day forth, you will be my slave, which will therefore make me indispensable. After my imprinting, no other woman will be sufficient for you. Not even another honored Matre. Her smiling lips looked as ragged as torn paper. Your service in past years has earned you this reward. Most males do not survive so long among us. Uxtal didn't dare run, lest he enrage her. This was the lingering threat that he had feared for years. He saw an unquenchable orange fire begin to burn in Ingva's eyes. Sexual bonding, total enslavement to this hideous crone. You are about to discover my pleasures. She caressed his face with a bony, clawed finger. You're going to enjoy this. That is not possible, honored Matre. She cackled. Little man, I am an adept of the Fifth Order, a qualified member of the Black Veil. I can overcome any blockage of desire. She grabbed him by the arm and dragged him to the floor. She was too strong, and he could not fight her off. Smiling as she straddled him, Ingva said, Now for your reward. The gnarled woman ripped his clothes away, and Uxtal prayed that he would survive this day. He whimpered. Years ago, at the very beginning, the face dancers had tried to protect him before delivering him to Bandalong, but Crone had not shown himself here for some time. The face dancer had discarded the lost Tliloxu researcher as soon as he'd provided the Paul Atreides gola. Crone had simply left him at the mercy of the honored Matres. The face dancers could do nothing to protect him from Ingva's fury once she discovered what had been done to him. With sinewy, greedy hands, the crone reached down, gasped, and then hurled him across the floor naked. Castrated? Who did that to you? The face dancers. Long ago, I needed to concentrate on my work without the temptation of an honored Matre's pleasures. You disgusting, stupid little man. Do you know what you have denied yourself? What you have denied me? Uxtal slipped away, scrambling to retrieve the remnants of his clothing before she killed him out of sheer indignation. But Ingva moved like a panther to intercept him. I have never been pleased with you, little man, and now you have made my job more difficult. Castration, however, does not render you utterly useless as a sexual slave. To an adept with my skill level, even a eunuch is not entirely unreachable. It will require extra effort, but I will imprint you anyway. She pushed him back down to the floor. You will thank me for this when it's over. I promise you that. Uxtal argued, whined, and then screamed, but no one heard or cared. The hunt has been a fundamental part of the natural order since life first emerged. The prey knows this as well as the predator. Bene Gesserit dictum. Alone on their breezy observation platform above the giant aspen trees, the Gola of Thufir Hawat tried to absorb everything and see everything, adding details together for a correct summation and analysis. He was not yet a Mentat, but according to historical records, Thufir had the potential to be a great warrior, a strategist, and a human computer. In his original lifetime, he had served three generations of House Atreides. After the fall of Erekin, the Harkonnens had captured him and used a residual poison to coerce him to serve the evil Baron. How I must have hated that. Back then, Thufir had been an old veteran, his mind heavy with a lifetime of service and battles. Somewhat like the old Bashar. Young Thufir very much wanted to live up to those expectations. Even here, safely high above the ground, he could smell blood in the air from the hunt. Two lanky handlers stood guard at the base of the wooden tower to protect him and the rabbi from the dangerous futars and honored matres loose in the forest. Or were the handlers simply making certain their two visitors didn't go anywhere off limits and didn't see anything they weren't supposed to see? The anxious rabbi paced across the open platform and peered down into the broad grove of silver-barked trees. Thufir had already made enough of an analysis of the old man to predict how he would react in a situation. Hardened by a lifetime of feeling wrongfully downtrodden, the rabbi fought for his people while trying not to be seen as a victim. Most of all, he feared being indecisive, anything less than a leader. Now the old man looked sickened and disappointed, as if his dreams of having a perfect new world for his followers were draining away. Would the Jewish refugees ask to stay on this planet, despite the possibility of further honored Matre attacks? Even with the handlers' odd behavior and their vicious futars, which the rabbi found repellent for religious reasons? What would the rabbi decide as he weighed the advantages and disadvantages? Thufir was sure he and his fellow young Golas would never come here to live. They belonged on the Ithaca with the Bashar and Duncan Idaho, ready to defend against the outside enemy. That was why they had been reborn in the first place. Even if some of the refugees left the no-ship to settle on the planet, Duncan would never allow the Ithaca to remain here. Motionlessness creates vulnerability. Complacency is dangerous. Regardless of how welcoming the handlers might seem, this planet could only be a temporary stopover for most of them. Though his past life memories had not been restored, Thufir's loyalties remained with the people aboard the ship. In the forest below, he heard snarling futars and the sharp cracking of branches. He shaded his eyes, trying to discern details from shadows in the trees as the chase came toward them. I do not like this. The rabbi raised his hands in a warning gesture. It will take more than a superstitious symbol to block these attackers. You may think yourself safer, Gola, because you will someday be a warrior, but I fight in a much more important arena. Faith is my weapon, the only one I need. Below, they saw the cautious predatory movement of two futars slinking through the trees to set a trap. Thufir realized what was happening. With loud roars in the distance, other beastmen were driving an honored matre in this direction, and then the rest of the pack would close in on her. Using implanted communication devices, the handler guards at the base of the tower received an update. They turned their bandit-masked eyes up to the observation platform. Three of the five honored matres have been killed, one called. The hunting ability of our futars is proven. But two of the deadly women remained alive, and one was coming toward the observation tower at that very moment. She ran out of the trees, her face scratched by lashing branches, her left arm mauled and hanging useless, her bare feet torn and bleeding from fleeing across the rough ground. but she showed no signs of slowing. The rabbi squirmed and put a hand over his eyes, as if offended. I will not watch this. As the woman burst into the clearing, looking over her shoulder, two futars sprang from their hiding places in the trees and surprised their prey. Another pair of hunting futars closed in from behind her, running hard. Thufir leaned over the railing to get a better view, while the rabbi cringed back. Without pausing in her stride, the honored Matre bent to snatch up a fallen branch with her good hand. Using amazing strength, she spun and shoved it like a wobbly, off-balance javelin. The splintered end skewered one of the leaping futars. Mortally wounded, he fell, yelping and thrashing as she sprang aside. Another futar jumped the woman, striking at her wounded side, hoping to latch onto her shoulder and wrench her already mauled arm out of its socket. Thufir saw instantly that the honored Matre had merely been feigning the severity of her injury. Her mangled arm darted up and grabbed the futar by his throat. His jaws snapped only a centimeter from her face. With a loud grunt, the whore pushed the creature away. The futar staggered backward and crashed into one of the silvery trunks. Stunned, he struggled to his feet. As the other two futars closed with her, the honored Matre looked sideways, her orange eyes fixed on the two handlers standing guard by the lookout tower. With a burst of desperate, vengeful speed, she ran directly toward them, leaving the beast men behind. Both of the long, lanky men raised their stun goads, but she outmatched them with a hurricane of movement. Her calloused hand knocked the staffs away, and she drove in, relishing the brief look of fear behind her first victim's eyes. With a single, powerful blow, she broke the handler's neck, and he crumpled to the ground. She lunged toward the second handler, but the nearest futar intercepted her to protect his master. The other two beast men came closer, one of them limping. Seeing that she could not fight off the creatures, the honored Matre grabbed the fallen stun goad and bounded off into the forest again. Snarling, the futars ran after her. Thufir grabbed the rabbi's arm. Quickly! He went to the steep wooden stairs that would take them down to the ground. Maybe we can help. The rabbi hesitated. But he is already dead, and it is safe up here. We should stay. I am tired of being a spectator. Thufir descended swiftly, two creaking steps at a time. The rabbi came after him, grumbling. When Thufir reached the ground, the remaining handler guard was bent over his comrade. Thufir expected to hear the lanky man wailing in grief or shouting in anger. Instead, he seemed more intent. Unusual. Curious. From far off in the forest came a blood-curdling shriek as the three futars cornered the honored Matre again. She hurled obscenities. Thufir heard a crashing violence, a crack that sounded like breaking bone, terrible snarls followed by a brief scream, and then silence. After a moment's pause, Thufir's sensitive ears caught the unmistakable sounds of feeding. Huffing great breaths, the rabbi reached the base of the observation tower and steadied himself by holding the wooden rail. Thufir hurried toward the handler and his dead companion. Is there anything we can do to help? Hunched over, the surviving handler's back suddenly tensed, as if he'd forgotten the two were there. He swiveled his head on a long neck and looked at them. The dark band was a heavy shadow across his eyes. Then Thufir glimpsed the dead handler lying on the ground. The corpse's features had shifted, changed, reverted. He was no longer tall and lanky, and his face was not streamlined. He had no black mask around his eyes. Instead, the dead handler had grayish skin, dark, close-set eyes, and a pug nose. Thufir recognized it from archival images. A face dancer. The other handler guard glared at them, then let his face revert to its neutral state. No longer human, but cadaverous and blank. Thufir's mind spun, and he wished desperately that he had Mentat abilities. The handlers were face dancers? All of them, or just a few? Handlers fought the honored Matres, a common enemy. The enemy. Handlers. Face dancers. Enemy. This planet was not at all as it seemed. He flashed a glance at the rabbi. The old man had seen the same thing, and though his horror and surprise had made him freeze for an instant, he seemed to be drawing the same conclusions. The powerful handler drew himself up and came toward them with his stun goad. "We'd better run," Thufir said. Even the most delicate plans can be thrown into turmoil by an impetuous action from our supposed masters. Is it not ironic when they claim that face dancers are shiftless and changeable? Crone, communique to face dancer Myriad. From inside the reconstructed Castle Caladan, Crone pulled his strings, played his roles, and moved his game pieces. The face dancer Myriad had manipulated the Ixians, the Guild, Chome, and the honored Matre rebels who still ruled Tlilox. They had already achieved many milestones of success. Crone had traveled wherever he was needed, wherever he was summoned, but he always came back here to his pair of precious golas, the Baron and Paolo. The work continued. On Caladan, year after year, the group of machine-augmented observers sent regular reports back to the distant old man and woman. Despite their bodily degeneration, they showed damnable patience, and still they'd found nothing to fault him for. Crone was always watched by the patchwork observers, but never discovered. Even those hideous spies didn't know everything. The summons came to him from the castle tower, interrupting his work and concentration. Crone trudged up the stone staircase to see what the spies wanted. When they invoked the name of their masters, he could not refuse. Not yet. He had to keep up appearances for a little while longer, until he could finish this part of his project. He knew the old man and woman understood the wisdom of his alternative plan. Since their efforts to find the lost no-ship kept failing, it made sense to pursue another route for obtaining their Kwisatz Haderach, the Paolo Gola. But would the old man and woman allow him the necessary time to awaken the child? Paolo was only 6, and it would be several years yet before Crone could even begin the process of triggering his memories, saturating him with spice, preparing him for his destiny. The distant masters had made their demands and set their schedules. According to sparse reports from the patchwork observers, the old man and woman were ready to launch their vast fleet on a long-anticipated conquest of everything, whether the Kwisatz Haderach was ready or not. Silent and stony, the hideous emissaries awaited him inside the high tower room. Just as Crone reached the top of the winding stairs, the men turned with stuttering movements to face him. He put his hands on his hips. "You are delaying my work." One emissary's head twitched from side to side, as if his neurons were firing conflicting impulses that caused his neck and shoulder muscles to spasm. "This message... we cannot deliver this message ourselves." He balled his bony hand into a fist. Bubbles gurgled through the tubes. "Deliver a message. What is it?" Crone crossed his arms. "I have work to complete for our masters." The lead emissary opened his hands wide in a beckoning gesture. The other augmented humans stood motionless, presumably recording his every movement. Crone stepped into the gallery room while the pale-faced horrors retreated to the wall. He frowned. What is this? Suddenly, his vision fuzzed around the edges, and the walls of the tower became indistinct. Reality shifted around him. At first, Crone saw the ethereal grid of the net, strands of connected tachyons completing an infinite chain. Then he found himself in another place, a simulation of a simulation. He heard the sound of plodding hoofs, smelled manure, and listened to the creaking of rough wheels. Turning to his right, he saw the old man and old woman sitting in a wooden cart drawn by a gray mule. The beast walked along with infinite weariness and patience. No one seemed to be in a hurry. Crone had to take a step to follow the cart, which was loaded high with Paradon melons, their olive-green rinds mottled with splotchy patterns. He looked around, trying to understand the metaphor of their dream world. Far ahead, the road led toward crowded geometric buildings that seemed to move and flow together, an enormous city that looked alive. The perfectly angled structures were like patterns on a circuit board. In the foreground, the old man sat next to the woman on the buckboard, casually holding leather reins. He looked down at Crone. We have news. Your time-consuming project is no longer relevant. We have no need for you or your Baron Harkonnen, or for the Paul Atreides Gola you have grown for us. The old woman chimed in other words, we will not have to wait so many years for your alternative Kwisatz Haderach candidate. The man lifted the reins and urged the mule to greater speed, but the beast ignored the command. It is time to be done with all this tinkering. Crone walked along beside them. What do you mean? I am ever so close to... For 19 years, our sophisticated nets have failed to capture the no-ship, but now we've been fortunate. We have laid a primitive trap, an old-fashioned trick, and very soon the no-ship and all those aboard will be in our control. We will have what we need without resorting to your alternative Kwisatz Haderach. Your plan is obsolete. Crone gritted his teeth, trying not to show his alarm. How did you find the ship after all this time? My face dancers. The ship came to our planet of handlers, and now we have them. The old man smiled, revealing perfect white teeth. We are about to spring our trap. On the buckboard, the woman leaned back and said, when we have the no-ship and its passengers, we will control what the mathematical prophecy says we require. All of our prescient-level projections indicate that the Kwisatz Haderach is aboard. He will stand beside us during Kralizek. Our massive fleets are about to launch a full-scale offensive against the worlds of the old empire. It will all be over soon. We have waited so long. The old man snapped the reins again, looked smug. The old woman's wrinkled lips curled upward in an apologetic smile. Therefore, Crone, your time-consuming and costly plan simply isn't necessary anymore. Aghast, the face dancer took two more steps beside the cart to maintain his pace. But you can't do that. I have already awakened the Baron's memories, and the Paolo Gola is perfect, ripe for our purposes. Speculation. We no longer need him, the old man repeated. Once we seize the no-ship, we will have the Kwisatz Haderach. As if she were giving him a consolation prize, the woman reached into the back of the cart, selected a small Paradon melon, and extended it to Crone. It was nice to work with you. Here, have a melon. He took it, confused and disturbed. The illusion around him twinkled and washed out, fading until he found himself back in the tower room. He was empty-handed, his palms cradling a non-existent Paradon melon. He found himself standing at the very edge of the high tower window, his feet on the brink. The plaza panes were open, and a gusty sea breeze slapped his face. The stomach-lurching drop extended to the rugged rocks at the tide line far below. Another half-step, and he would plunge to his death. Crone pinwheeled his arms and staggered backward, collapsing to the flagstone floor with an embarrassing lack of grace. The augmented emissaries regarded him coolly from the side of the tower room. With considerable effort, Crone maintained his composure. He didn't even speak to the patchwork monstrosities, but stalked out of the tower chamber. No matter what the old man and old woman said, Crone would not abandon his plans until he was finished with them. To a seasoned fighter, each battle is a banquet. Victory should be savored like the finest wine or the most extravagant dessert. Defeat is like a rancid chunk of meat. Teachings of the Swordmasters of Ganaz. The 60 ships descended to the heart of Bandalong, where Helica would be waiting for them. Mirbella was sure that the Matre Superior intended to savor this confrontation, toying with what she saw as an inferior opponent. The pretender queen would expect true Bene Gesserit behavior from the new sisterhood. Discussions and negotiations. It would be a game to her. Mirbella, though, was not entirely Bene Gesserit. She had a surprise for the honored Matres below. Several, in fact. Her ships circling over the palace were far outnumbered by Helica's forces on the ground. The whores expected civilized behavior from the mother commander, diplomatic protocols, ambassadorial courtesies. Mirbella had already decided that would be a waste of time. Jeunesse, Korea, and the other infiltrator sisters in the city below knew what to do. Precisely on cue, as Mirbella's escort squad prepared to land in the Matre Superior's trap, 7 major buildings in Bandalong erupted into flames. Concussion waves knocked down walls, blasting honored Matre emplacements into cinders. Moments later, 3 bombs vaporized dozens of ships on the spaceport landing field. Before the stunned whores around the palace could try to shoot down her escort ships, Mirbella yelled into the comm line, "Valkyries, launch your attack!" Her escort ships began their bombardment, wiping out the protective forces that encircled the Matre Superior's seat of power. Out of harsh necessity, Mirbella had decreed Bandalong expendable. Helica and her rebels were a dangerous firebrand to be extinguished. Period. The whores below went into a frenzy, rushing about like hornets from a burning nest. Then, from orbit, Bashar Wiki Azton launched a second, far more overwhelming wave of new sisterhood warships. The second, unseen guild ship dropped its no-field beside Edric's giant highliner. Suddenly, 200 more Valkyrie attack ships plunged out of the open hold and streaked down to the battleground. Up until the date of its untimely obliteration, Richesi had made regular deliveries of armaments and specially tailored battleships. Though the largest part of the huge fleet had been turned to slag along with the rest of the weapon shops, Chapter House possessed more than enough firepower to render this last honored Matre stronghold helpless. Bashar Azzedine led waves of ships in performing surgical strikes on the strategic targets and key installations that had been identified in the covert transmissions from the infiltrator team. From her hiding place, Jeunesse activated her own communication lines and coordinated her saboteurs with the swarms of newly landed troops. While other Sisterhood fighters fanned out across the city and surrounding lands, the honored Matres scrambled to mount a defense against such a widespread and thorough assault. The Mother Commander and her Valkyries landed outside the palace. Mirbella positioned military transport vessels to form a complete blockade. Her black-uniformed fighters poured out onto the ground and surrounded the gaudy structure. Smiling to herself, Mirbella went in to kill the Matre Superior. No prisoners. It was the only way this could end. Accompanied by her entourage of Valkyries, the Mother Commander marched through the main entrance. Honored Matre guards in purple leotards and capes rushed to engage the invader, but the new Sisterhood fighters swiftly subdued them. Inside the palace, her group passed a bubbling fountain of red liquid that looked and smelled like blood. Statues of honored Matres thrust swords through frozen Bene Gesserit sisters. Scarlet fluid poured from the victim's wounds into the bowl of the fountain. Mirbella pointedly ignored the grotesquerie. Without a misstep, the Mother Commander found her way to the main throne room and strode in under full guard, as if she owned all of Tlilox. Despite the intrinsic violence of the honored Matres, the victory of the far superior sisters was a foregone conclusion. Mirbella had learned, however, from studying the Battle of Junction, where even Bashar Miles Teg had been lured by a triumph that was too easy. She kept her mind and body in the highest state of alert. Honored Matres had a way of twisting defeat into victory. Preening on her high throne, an unrepentant Helica awaited them, as if she remained in control of the situation. "So nice of you to come calling, witch." The pretender queen wore a red, yellow, and blue costume that looked more suitable for a circus performer than for the leader of a planet. Her tightly knotted bun of blonde hair was studded with priceless jewels and sharp decorative pins. "You are brave to come here, and foolish." Boldly, Mirbella approached the throne. "It seems to me your city is burning, Helica. You should have joined us against the coming enemy. You are going to die anyway. Why not die fighting a real opponent?" Helica laughed boisterously. "The enemy can't be fought. That is why we take what we wish and then move on to fertile ground before the first forces arrive. However, if your witches wish to distract the enemy with pointless battles, we will welcome the delay so that we may slip away more easily." Mirbella couldn't understand what Helica intended to accomplish, why she had rallied her rebels, drawing them all into a debilitating conflict that none of them could win. The enclaves of violent holdouts had caused much damage. Richesi was only the worst example, weakening humanity. To what purpose? "We were nearly ready to depart from Tlilox. Right now, you are in my way." The Matre Superior stood, then dropped into a fighting stance. "On the other hand, if I kill you and take over your new sisterhood for myself, perhaps we'll stay a while longer. At one time, I might have tried to re-educate you. Now I see that the effort would be wasted." Helica wanted this conflict. Apparently, she had no illusions about surviving, knowing the bloody battles occurring all across Bandalong. Her intent must have been to maximize casualties, nothing more. More explosions rang throughout the city. Staring hard at the beautiful woman, Mirbella imagined Helica dead, slumped at the base of the dais holding her throne. The vision was so clear it seemed like a gift of prescience, a classic swordmaster technique. At the edges of her vision, Mirbella noticed flickering shadows, bodies moving stealthily around the throne room. Dozens of honored Matre guards closing in, a surprise ambush. But it would never be enough. Her own Valkyries had been waiting for this trap, the desperate last stand. More than prepared to fight, they turned their superior numbers against them and plunged into the fray. Overhead, Bashar Aztin's clustered attack ships roared across the sky, making the whole palace shake. Mirbella bounded up the steps to the dais as Helica vaulted over one of the armrests. The two grappled like asteroids colliding, but Mirbella used her balance to throw her weight with a swordmaster reorienting technique and drove Helica to the floor. Rolling on the stone tiles in a flurry of deadly blows and blocks, Mirbella and the pretender queen tore at each other. The mother commander clawed a long gouge down Helica's cheek, then the other woman smashed her forehead into Mirbella's, stunning her just long enough to tear herself free. Springing to their feet, the opponents faced off, and the Matre superior demonstrated unorthodox fighting techniques, subtly advanced from anything Mirbella remembered in her own honored Matre training. So, Helica had learned, or changed. In response, Mirbella altered her timing, sought the opportunity to strike, but the other woman moved with an unexpected flash, more swiftly than Mirbella could dodge. A hard, stinging blow bruised her left thigh, but the mother commander did not go down. She blocked her nerve receptors, numbed the pain in her leg, and then threw herself back into the fight. An honored Matre fought with violent impulsiveness, sheer strength and speed. Mirbella possessed those traits herself, combined with the finesse of the long-forgotten swordmaster art, as well as the best Bene Gesserit skills. Once Mirbella reset her mind and her approach, the Matre superior had no chance. Envisioning an unexpected response of her own, Mirbella planned a sequence of moves and countermoves a few seconds into the future. The non-pattern in Helica's fighting style was really a pattern when viewed from a larger perspective. Mirbella didn't need a sword, needed no weapon at all, in fact, just herself. Despite the Matre superior's flurry of movement, the parries, punches, and kicks, Mirbella saw a straight line of vulnerability and acted. The instant she envisioned it, her path of attack became no more than an afterthought. The action was over and successful as soon as she undertook it. With the force of a pile driver, her right foot found its way under Helica's ribcage and smashed straight into the heart. Helica's eyes opened wide, and she mouthed a curse without getting the words out. She spilled onto the floor at the base of the dais, exactly as Mirbella had foreseen her moments before. Panting, the mother commander turned away and assessed the handful of still-living honored Matre guards locked in combat with the Valkyries. Many discarded bodies in bright leotards already lay strewn across the tiles, along with far fewer sisters. "Hold! I am your Matre superior now." "We do not follow witches," one woman snapped indignantly, smearing blood from her mouth and ready to keep fighting. "We are not fools." With her peripheral vision, Mirbella noticed the dead Matre superior beginning to change. The mother commander turned back to her victim and caught the impossible shifting. Helica's face went slack and grayish white. Her eyes sank in, her hair writhed and altered. The thing that had been the pretender queen sprawled in gaudy clothes. Pug nose, tiny mouth, black button eyes. Mirbella's mind raced, and she seized the moment of astonishment and disbelief. You had no qualms against following a face dancer? Now, who is the fool? How many more of you are face dancers? Even as they fought the Valkyries, the remaining honored Matres glimpsed the blank-faced creature that had been Helica. More of the horrors stuttered to a halt, staring in shock.
Matres Superior! She is not human!
Behold your leader, Mirbella ordered, strutting forward. You obeyed the orders of a face dancer planted among you. You were deceived and betrayed. Only one of the honored Matre guards continued to battle furiously. The Valkyries soon dispatched her, and Mirbella was not shocked to see the fallen woman transform into a second face dancer. Here, and on Gamu. How far had this insidious infiltration spread? Helica's provocative actions had somehow served the face dancers rather than the whores. Was it a plot spawned by the lost Tliloxu, or did it extend even farther than that? Who were the shapeshifters really fighting for? Could they already be a vanguard from the enemy, sent into the old empire to assess and weaken the target? All those rebel enclaves, the dissent and violence that drained the resources of the new sisterhood, could it all have been a plot to weaken humanity's defenses? Setting them against each other? Killing viable fighters to make the defenses vulnerable so that the enemy could wade in and finish the job more easily? With the main fight over in the city, more of her Valkyries streamed into the throne room, consolidating their hold on the gaudy palace. Throughout Bandalong, Helica's remaining followers fought to the death, while the Guild Highliner remained up in stationary orbit, observing the fray from a safe distance. Her daughter, Jeunesse, looking battered but bright-eyed, led them.
Mother Commander, the palace is ours.
The enemy of your enemy is not necessarily your friend. He may hate you as much as any other rival. Hawat's strategic corollary. With the deadly hunt over and all five honored Matres dead, Shiana and Teg descended the wooden steps of the open-framed lookout tower. It had been an exhilarating as well as unsettling experience. Shiana sensed that the young Bashar beside her wrestled with his own questions, extrapolations, and suspicions, but he could not voice any of them without the guards overhearing. The handlers were gathering by their futars in the leaf-strewn clearing where the last honored Matre had been torn to pieces in plain view. Herm and the black-striped futar had fought over, then jointly brought down, the last of the terrible whores. It had been a dizzying fight, with the two futars circling, lashing out, and dodging the woman's hands and feet. When she leapt high with a kick, Herm had reached out and caught her ankle with his claws, like catching a fish on a hook, and slammed her to the forest floor. Blackstripe had lunged in to tear out her throat. Scarlet droplets spattered the carpet of golden leaves. Walking away from the observation platform, Shiana and Teg went to stand by the futars with cold, wary fascination. Recognizing her, Herm gave her a bloody grin, as if expecting Shiana to come forward and give him a back rub. She sensed his need for acceptance, and for years she had been the only one to give it to him. Though the handlers, the true masters, were there in the forest now, Shiana said,
"Excellent work, Herm. I am proud of you."
A deep purr rumbled in his throat. Then he dug his face into the honored Matre's pale flesh and ripped out another mouthful of meat. Shiana had not seen the other three Futars from the no-ship, but knew they must have joined the hunt as well. Four of the lanky natives, including the chief handler, stood watching the grisly scene, apparently satisfied with the creature's performance. Orak Tho said, "Now you see our true feelings for the honored Matres."
"We never doubted it," Shiana said, "but another enemy is coming. One that those horrors provoked. That enemy is far worse."
"Worse? How do you know this?" the chief handler said. "What if there is nothing to fear from this other enemy? Perhaps you have misunderstood." Shiana noticed the other handlers subtly closing in around them. Teg picked up on it too, but showed no obvious reaction. Standing amidst the bloody remnants of the hunt, Orak Tho surprised them by changing the subject. "And now that we have shown our goodwill, I would like to visit your no-ship. I will bring a party of handlers with me to see it." Teg gave her a subtle sign of caution. "That is indeed something we should consider," she said, "but we must first discuss it with our companions. We have much to tell them about your gracious hospitality and all that you have shown us." Trying not to reveal his concern, Teg added, "We have only a small lighter. We'll need to arrange transport for your visiting party."
"We have our own ships."
The chief handler turned as if the decision had already been made. Teg and Shiana flashed a look at each other.
"Their own ships?"
The handlers had already talked about having scanners sophisticated enough to detect the Ithaca in orbit. This civilization was far more technologically sophisticated than it appeared to be. The odors of the handlers, of coppery spilled blood, and of the musky Futars mixed with the forest air in a medley of confusing and disturbing smells. Shiana also detected a faint, familiar undertone of unwarranted tension. Beside the half-devoured corpse of the honored Matre, Herm and Blackstripe looked up, sensing something amiss. Both Futars growled deep in their throats. Shiana interrupted. "Will the rabbi and Thufir Hawat be rejoining us soon?" Orak Tho continued as if he had not heard her question.
"I will signal my people. I am certain your companions would agree. We will do this as efficiently as possible."
The nearby handlers stiffened. Their movements were subtle, but she noticed the people slowly coiling into fighting stances, elbows cocked, legs ready to spring.
"They are going to attack."
"Miles!"
Shiana shouted. The young Bashar lashed out in a strike so swift it was no more than a flicker of movement to the naked eye. Shiana ducked, thrust her palm into the face of another handler, and flung herself sideways as the people closed in. Teg struck one man in the center of the chest with a cracking blow strong enough to freeze his heart, an ancient but deadly Bene Gesserit fighting technique. Shiana grabbed the long forearm of another handler and, snapping it backward, broke the bone above the elbow. More handlers loped like predators from the dense aspens. The natives fought with the clear intent to kill, not even asking Shiana and Teg to surrender.
"But what will the handlers do when they kill us? How will they get aboard the no-ship if that's what they want?"
Though they were only two people, Shiana and Teg held their own, but only tenuously. In a storm of muscles and claws, Herm attacked, striking not her or the Bashar, but the chief handler. Orak Tho opened his wide mouth in surprise and barked a sharp, guttural command, but Herm did not stop. The Futar had broken his conditioning. Herm drove the handler to the ground as he snarled her name, Shiana. In unthinking frenzy, he bit down and twisted sideways, snapping Orak Tho's long neck.
Herm, knowing nothing of politics or alliances, fought the other Beastman and defended Shiana against the Handlers. He'd done it for her. Everything happened in seconds. While the Futar stood from his kill, Orak Tho changed. His dead flesh shifted to the inhuman features of a face dancer. The other Handler Teg had already killed also shifted. Face dancers. In the past, Shiana had always trusted her ability to recognize the shapeshifters by their distinctive pheromones, but the new face dancers were far more sophisticated, undetectable even by the Bene Gesserit. She had known that much before leaving Chapter House. Pieces clicked into place like chits on a counting machine. If these Handlers were new generation face dancers, then they were not allies after all, but enemies. Just because both the Handlers and the Bene Gesserit hated honored Matres did not necessarily mean that the two shared a common cause. Roaring, the black-striped Futar leapt into the fight and attacked the traitorous Herm. The two growling Futars fought, thrashing and flailing in a tumble of claws and teeth. Shiana could do nothing to help him, turning to see another threat. Several of the bandit-masked men also reverted to their face-dancer shapes, no longer bothering to maintain the disguises. All of the Handlers seemed to be face-dancers. Orak Tho had wanted to come aboard the no-ship, and now the reasons were obvious. The Handlers intended to capture the Ithaca. For the enemy. The enemy had always been after the no-ship. That was why the chief Handler was so willing to kill the two of them now. Face dancers could easily take the place of Shiana and Teg, taking not only their appearance, but also memory and personality imprints. Face dancers could work from within to accomplish what the Hunters had not been able to do from afar. They had to warn Duncan. Shiana struck at another Handler, driving him back into his comrades. As Teg fought beside her, his Mentat awareness processed the same data, and Shiana was sure he came to the same conclusions. They are all connected. The old man and woman, the net, the Handlers, the face dancers. Let's go. At least one of us has to live. Shiana knew another sickening truth. Thufir and the rabbi are probably dead. That's why the Handlers separated us. Divide and kill. From the edge of the tall aspens, two more hunting Futars bounded into the fray, instinctively drawn to fight against Herm, who had turned on them. It was inconceivable that a Futar had attacked a Handler. Shiana didn't see how she and the Bashar could possibly defeat all the opponents arrayed against them. Herm continued to fight, though he could not last much longer. He surged up, grasped Black Stripe's neck, and sank his claws into the throat, tearing out the larynx in a stringy, bloody lump. Even as his life's blood gushed out, the striped Futar continued to snap with sharp teeth. Then Herm went down under the additional Futars in a snarling mass of claws and torn, hairy skin. In a matter of moments, the Futars would turn on her and Teg.
Miles!
Shiana struck a Handler full in the face, and he went down. Beside her, Teg suddenly blurred, moving with such speed that she could no longer keep track of him. It was as if a wind rushed through the aspens. All of the Handlers closing in on them dropped to the ground like felled trees. Shiana barely had time to blink. Teg reappeared beside her, gasping for breath and looking drained.
Come with me. Back to the lighter. Now.
Her questions about him could wait. She ran with him. Herm had bought enough time for Shiana to escape, and she wouldn't let his sacrifice be wasted.
Behind them came the noises of more futars, their hands and feet crackling in the dry leaves and twigs that covered the forest floor. Would the other three from the no-ship help her, as Herm had? She could not count on it. She had seen them take down combat-hardened, honored Matres, and she didn't think much of her own chances against so many of them. No doubt, more handlers would be waiting at the wooden city towers. Some had probably surrounded the lighter already. How coordinated was Orak Tho's plan? Were all handlers really face dancers, or had they simply been infiltrated? Shiana and Teg dashed past the handler's main settlement. More raccoon-faced people were emerging from the cylindrical wooden structures, slow to react to the changed situation, all of them closing in. Ahead in the clearing, the small ship sat waiting for them. As she had feared, two tall handlers stood in front of the hatch, carrying powerful stun goads. Shiana prepared for a life-or-death fight. In front of her, Teg shifted and blurred again, shooting forward like a bullet, his speed beyond human possibility. The two handler guards turned, but they were too late. Teg's blows hit them like lightning strikes. The handlers snapped aside as if thrown by an invisible force. Shiana ran to catch up, her lungs on fire. Slowing enough to reappear, the Bashar kicked the stun goads out of the way. Reeling with exhaustion, he keyed the entry code into the lighter's main hatch controls. The hydraulics hummed, and the heavy door began to slide open.
Inside. Quickly. He heaved great breaths. We've got to take off.
Shiana had never seen a human look so utterly weary. Teg's skin had gone gray, and he seemed to be on the verge of collapse. She grabbed his arm, fearing that he was in no condition to fly the lighter.
I might have to do it myself.
Handlers swarmed out of the towers carrying staffs and stun goads. With nothing to hide anymore, most of them had reverted to their pug-nosed face-dancer appearances. Shiana feared that some might be armed with projectile throwers or long-distance stunners. With a shout and a frantic rush behind them, two people bolted out of the dense aspen forest, running for all they were worth. Shiana pushed Teg inside the ship and paused at the hatch, where she saw Thufir Hawat and the rabbi running pell-mell toward her. More handlers were hard on their heels, and she heard futars crashing through the underbrush. Thufir and the rabbi were both flushed, stumbling forward only seconds ahead of their pursuers. The young man grabbed the rabbi and hauled him along. She did not think they would reach the lighter in time. Finally, with selfless resolve, Thufir propelled the old man toward the still distant lighter while he turned alone to face the handlers. With balled fists, he lunged toward the closest pursuer, surprising him with his turnabout. A sharp rabbit punch to the abdomen of the handler and a chop to his throat caused the face dancer to reel and drop. Through his heroics, Thufir had given the rabbi time to stagger ahead as fast as he could. Panting but refusing to rest, Thufir then ran after him, catching up to the old man as they closed in on the ship in the meadow. As the first futar bounded forward, another beastman crashed in from the side, slamming into the ship. The pair rolled together, clawing and fighting. A second one of Herm's futars. The delay gained Shiana and her companions a few more precious seconds. She grabbed one of the stun goads from the fallen guards.
Run! Run!
Over her shoulder, she called into the open lighter,
Miles, start the engines!
Thufir and the rabbi ran with last bursts of adrenaline.
Face dancers, Thufir gasped. We saw... I know. Get inside the lighter.
The ship's engines began to thrum. Somehow, Teg had found enough energy to drag himself to the pilot's seat. Shiana planted her feet in the meadow grass and jabbed the stun goad at the first oncoming handler, then swung it to smash the side of another's head. The old rabbi stumbled aboard while the 12-year-old Gola lurched after him. Three more futars came bounding out of the trees, followed by another group of handlers. She threw herself through the hatch, scrambling to activate the ramp controls. She dragged her feet out of the way just as the heavy hatch sealed shut. With a crash, the first futar slammed into the hull.
"Fly, Miles!" She collapsed onto the deck. "Fly!"
Thufir Hawat was already in the co-pilot seat. Beside him, the Bashar looked as if he might lose consciousness at any moment, and Thufir reached for the co-pilot's controls, ready to take charge. But Teg brushed the boy's hands away.
"I'll do it."
The lighter rose above the trees, accelerating into the sky. Heart pounding, Shiana looked at the rabbi on the floor beside her. His tear-streaked face was flushed with exertion, and she feared he might die of cardiac arrest now that he'd made it to the escape ship. Then she remembered what Orak Tho had told her. The handlers had their own spacecraft, and they would no doubt pursue them.
"Hurry."
Her voice was no more than a rasping whisper. Ashen-faced, Teg seemed to hear her, though. A burst of vertical acceleration pressed her against the floor. Radicals are only to be feared when you try to suppress them. You must demonstrate that you will use the best of what they offer. Leto Atreides II, the Tyrant. With his mind reeling and his body shuddering, Uxtal could not absorb what Ingva had done to him. Using powers he could neither comprehend nor resist, the old crone had wrung him like a dirty rag, then left him weak and shuddering, barely able to breathe, walk, or think. It should not have been possible. Barely even noticing the attack ships closing in on Bandalong, he managed to stumble back to his laboratory. He was more terrified of Ingva than of any falling bombs or raiders. At the same time, he found himself unable to drive the sensations from his mind, the pleasure she had inflicted upon him. He felt sick and unclean at the indelible memory of it. Uxtal hated this planet, this city, these women. And he couldn't stand feeling so completely out of control. For years, his greatest skill had been as a tightrope walker, constantly worried about what might happen to him if he didn't maintain his balance and alertness. But after his coital ordeal with Ingva, he could barely keep himself from collapsing at a time when he most needed his mental abilities. Then, the massive attack had begun throughout the city, from explosions at strategic centers, to the siege of the palace, to the sudden appearance of a fleet of Bene Gesserit warships in the skies. Hidden explosives had already destroyed some walls in his large research complex. Saboteurs and infiltrators must have come here ahead of time, and they had marked his laboratory as an important facility for the honored Matres. He staggered back into the main lab and inhaled deeply of the chemicals around the fresh axolotl tanks. He also picked up caustic cinnamon odor from his initial and unsuccessful experiments that Waff, still terrified, had suggested over the past several days. For now, Uxtal left the half-awakened Tliloxu master locked in his chambers. Uxtal ran for his life. He knew in his heart that despite the best efforts of Waff, the whole process was flawed. The resurrected old master did not, in fact, remember enough facts to make spice. His suggested methodology might have been a good beginning, but was not likely to achieve the desired results. Perhaps the two of them might have worked together to rediscover the process, but not with Bandalong under attack. However, If a guild highliner hovered overhead, maybe Navigator Edric would rescue him. The guild would surely want the awakened Waff Gola they had encouraged him to create. And Uxtal, too. The Navigator had to save both of them. Uxtal heard loud voices and the hum of machinery over the distinct percussive explosions of gunfire and artillery fire. A voice yelled, "We are under attack! Matres and males, defend us!" Further words were drowned out by the sounds of automatic weapons fire, projectile guns, and pulse stunners. He froze in his tracks as he heard something else. Ingva's voice. His muscles jerked in response, and Uxtal found his legs carrying him involuntarily toward the sound. Sexually bonded by the hideous woman, he felt an irresistible compulsion to defend her, to protect her from the outside threat. But he had no weapons and no training in combat arts. Grabbing a piece of metal pipe from a debris pile near a collapsed wall, he ran toward the sounds of battle, barely able to think straight. Uxtal saw at least 20 honored Matres engaged with a larger force of women in black, spiny single suits. The invaders fought equally well with bladed weapons, projectile guns, and bare hands. The new Sisterhood's Valkyries. Swinging the pipe, Uxtal scurried into the fray, jumping over the bleeding bodies of honored Matres. But the black-clad witches threw him aside, as if they didn't consider him worth killing. With superior fighting skills, the Valkyries easily overwhelmed the honored Matres. One of the women shouted, "Cease your fighting! Matres Superior is dead!" Running behind them from the palace, an appalled honored Matre cried, "Helica was a face dancer! We have been deceived!" Uxtal stumbled to his feet, astonished by the assertion. Crone had forced him to work in Bandalung, but the lost Tliloxu researcher had never understood why the honored Matres would cooperate with esoteric face dancer interests. If the Matre Superior herself had been a shape